Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
On News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. Thank you for subscribing, downloading, rating. We really appreciate it. Coming up on this week's programme, we speak to NASA about the clearest sign yet of life on Mars. If you'd like to get in touch with the show, you can email us, science@newstalk.com. You can find us on Twitter. We're at @NewstalkScience. We get to all of those comments at the end of the podcast. Now, time to look back at some of the breaking stories from the world of science this week. We're joined by Dr. Susan Kelleher, Associate Professor of Materials Chemistry at DCU, and Dr. Shane Bergen, Physicist and Science Communicator at UCD. You're both very welcome. Our first story has to do with eye drops. And this is a pretty cool story.
Yeah, I find this really interesting to read about. And so basically about 85% of people over the age of 45, maybe it's because I'm getting close to that age, I find this interesting, but over 85% of people...
You're not 45 yet.
No, not even close, Jonathan.
Oh.
Of course.
Next question. Yeah,
just listen to the story, Jonathan. You might be interested in it on account of your age. 85% of people over 45 have this thing called presbyopia, which is basically long-sightedness, or it's one of the things that can cause long-sightedness. And it's, in this case, it's where the lens inside the eye becomes less flexible with age. And this means then that the eye can't change shape as easily to focus on things that are close to you, which is where we get this idea of long-sightedness. And then people, as they get older, find, as we all know, that they start needing to wear reading glasses, etc. So this work, now it's not a study in a journal yet. It was just presented at a conference this week by Dr. Giovanna Benozzi, who's from Buenos Aires. So his work is was presented at the European Society of Cataract and Refractive Surgeons in Copenhagen, and showed that most people, when given eye drops, were then able to read extra lines on eye test charts after using them. The study was done with 766 people in Argentina, and they were given eye drops. They had to put them in their eyes two times a day. First when they woke up, and then 6 hours after that. And the cohort was broken into three groups who got the eye drops, and there were different formulations of the eye drops. The eye drops are made of two important things. The first is a molecule that will constrict the pupil and contract the muscle that controls the shape of the eye. So that's called pilocarpine. The second is diclofenac, which is a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory, which will reduce irritation when your eye is being kind of, you know, controlled by the molecule of the drug. And what they found was when they had the percentages of 1%, they kept the diclofenac at the same level. And then when they had concentrations of 1% pilocarpine, 2% or 3%, that you got the participants were able to read extra lines, and it was really, really significant. So the group that got the 1% version, basically about 96% of people were able to read two or more extra lines in that eye test that, you know, we all know and maybe not like, but, you know, as in, don't know, sometimes I get thrown by, I know it's a D, but it could be an R. So maybe I'm getting closer to 40, as I said, maybe this is becoming more relevant to me as I age. But with the 2% group, 69% were able to read three or more extra lines. And the 3% group, 84% of people were able to read three or more extra lines. So
that's amazing.
Really makes a big difference. And it lasted over, like, if you continued to use it, as the participants continued to use over 2 years, the effect remained. So it's not that it disappeared, you know, and the eye adjusted or anything like that. It was persistent in its effect. So it does look like these drops could be, or these types of drops could be, a really big game changer around whether or not, you know, you need glasses, or when you might need them and how to treat.
That's incredible. So this is, you know, essentially the reading glasses gone if these eye drops are seen to be safe and effective, and seems like they're incredibly effective. Do you have to take them every day to get the benefit?
So you take them every day and twice a day. And I think that's one of the things that I was kind of thinking about, like, you know, if you miss one and you don't miss it, and then you don't have your glasses with you, you know, like, you've this idea of rigorousness around taking something, you know, we know that in,
but it's not for medical benefit, right? It's different, where it's, you know, it's not something like a beta blocker or a statin, or, you know, something for, you know, for chemo, or to, you know, reduce your immune response. It's just to see a little bit better. So if you forget it, you know, it's I would imagine it's not that much of an impact on you. Your just eyes just go back to what they would have regressed it back to what they would have been. It's amazing.
Like, I presume, I mean, there's certainly a lot. They do say there's a lot more that needs doing. And there are some drugs like this and drops in the States that are FDA approved. They're not this and they're not, they don't quite claim the same. But I would say that, you know, they haven't studied what happens if you forget for a couple of days. Like, you go down for a weekend away and you forget your drops. And, you know, do you start from one again or does it just pick right back up? Yeah. So these are the things I guess they'll have to study, like the actual human usage and how, you know, how behaviors will change or, you know, adapt to putting these things in. But people do it with contact lenses. I mean, people who need that these things, you know, so
yeah, and that doesn't have any effect. Yeah, I'm not a doctor, but I think it'll be fine. Our second story, Shane, has to do with dark matter.
Yeah, here we are again. But this is one to watch, right? So dark matter, as listeners will well know, accounts for, we think, 85% of the mass of the universe. And we know it's there because of gravitational effects. Yeah, you roll your eyes. I know, we've been around this story. The problem is it's dark. We can't see it. So if we were going to be able to see it, we would have to be able to detect it. So when it interacts with the detector, we'd have to be able to notice that interaction. And we're struggling and have struggled to build appropriate detectors. This story is about a new detector. It has detected something. We're just not sure whether it's dark matter yet. So it's a pretty cool name, the detector. It's called Quantum Resolution Optimized Cryogenic Observatory for Dark Matter Incident at Low Energy, or crocodile, right? They call it crocodile because they have
talk
to get grant
money. Talk about dying for an acronym.
Yeah.
My God.
Absolutely. So basically what it does is it uses a property called superconductivity. It's able to measure tiny energies. Now, why are we interested in energy when we're talking about matter? Well, we can't really think about the mass of these things because they're so tiny. They would be so infinitesimally small that using units like kilogram would make absolutely no sense. So instead, particle physicists employ Einstein's E equals mc squared equation and express energy, express mass as an energy. So we talk about electron volts, which is a unit of energy. Now, for listeners, a tiny well-known particle like an electron is 500,000 electron volts. But this, which is just like a regular tiny particle, this new sensor is able to detect things at 0.1 electron volts. So you think of how tiny an electron is, and you think about going like a couple of orders of magnitude smaller than that, we now have an ultra-sensitive detector so that if it is bombarded by dark matter particles, it may be sensitive enough to actually to measure them. So we have early measurements, but they're not sure whether they're cosmic rays or whether they are actually dark matter signals.
Do you want a spoiler?
They're not. Is that what you're going
to say? Spoiler is they're not. They're not. Yeah.
Yeah.
Not. From now on, I'm just going to call it. I'm not allowing anyone to say dark matter, dark energy on the program because it sounds like it's a thing. We're going to call it magical energy and magical matter. And until someone can actually detect it, that's what I want to hear on the program. This is a new study looking at magical matter in the air because we don't know it exists. We can't measure it. And we think it's there because our maths are bad. That is essentially dark energy and dark matter in a nutshell. For
me,
a non-scientist who really doesn't know anything about this.
Yeah, you see, but this is the thing about science is often that like we can infer things are there. The way we can actually observe things is often indirect. So we can observe the gravitational effects.
Pretty
of this
indirect,
matter.
Though, this one. This is pretty indirect how we do the dark matter. We just go, there has to be something there.
But that's how we discover black holes. We couldn't see them, but we could see that there was a large gravitational effect. So,
and now we can see them.
But they're fortunately able to convince funders to give them the appropriate amount of money rather than the McRae School of Hard Knocks for scientific research.
Look, I've dug my grave and I'm going to sleep in it.
That's all right. I admire Susan, you for that.
Susan, our next story has to do with stressed children.
So this is, one of these bittersweet stories where it's quite a sad topic around the idea of chronic physical illness for children. You know, this is around children who have chronic physical illnesses. But it's also sort of a little bit of a light at the end of tunnel around some of the other conditions and issues that they face. So with stress in general, you know, when our body undergoes stress, whatever it might be, disease or, you know, some conditions, ultimately the goal is to develop methods that allow us to figure out what's going on in a minimally invasive way. And we know that there are now really minimally invasive tools that we can look at, like, you know, CT scans instead of putting probes into your body, etc., to figure out what's going on. But one part of the body that actually is really powerful in terms of its information for, you know, conditioned detecting and understanding what's going on in your body is your hair. And I think it's totally, you know, it's rather overlooked around what your the information and the clues that your hair can contain. So hair is always growing. And actually what happens is it can act like a kind of a rings on a tree to figure out what's going on over the course of somebody, you know, many years or months, and depending on how long your hair is. For example, you know, arsenic and lead and mercury can build up in hair, and then it can be used to figure out whether or not someone was poisoned, you know, many, many moons ago. So short hair on average, you can look back maybe about a week, but you can look back months for longer hair. So what they did, the studies around for these children that are struggling with some stresses in their bodies, it's around the hormone cortisol, so the stress hormone. And so cortisol is known to build up in your hair when you're stressed. And so what they've been able to do is for children with these chronic illnesses, they're often, you know, also exposed to and struggle with other challenges around mental health or suicidal tendencies, etc. But the hair, when you can look at the cortisol levels in the hair of these children, you're actually able to identify early on, like an early warning signal, that there is the stress hormone in their hair. And it actually then allowed you to kind of intervene a little bit sooner in some of these maybe mental health issues that children, you know, are having. So it's a really nice kind of biomarker and a biosignal that's a lot easier to get to than blood or, you know, any other kind of invasive tool. I think it's really interesting as a means, and hopefully it'll give them a bit of respite, you know.
Absolutely. And, you know, our hair has so much, other than that, so much to give, because, you know, the environment that it's in, there's so much information that we could take from it. And as you say, very, very easy to get your hands on. Our final story, Shane, has to do with ants. And this is a real world first, like genuinely world first.
Yeah, this is a story that's been published in Nature, which is one of the most prestigious scientific journals. It's the first time that scientists have observed a phenomenon known as xenoparity, which is the idea of...
Hang on, how do they have a name for it if it's the first time it's ever happened?
Well, because like word people have been there for thousands of years before us with the language to describe things that we... It's like, when we do discover dark matter, Jonathan, we will have a name for it. It'll be called dark matter. Yeah.
It will be called magical matter.
Maybe. Patent pending. This is an anomaly, right? That most species give birth to their own species, right? So this is a type of ant called Messer ibericus, right? And the queen in that species is able to give birth to its own species and another species called Messer structor. Now, this is incredible, right? So most of the colony is actually a hybrid of the two species. They make female workers and they do all the jobs. They can make male offspring of two varieties, however. They can make cloned sons. So they can use the structure sperm from it's like a sperm donor that they have within their latent DNA, and they don't use any of their own DNA with it. So they're able to produce a male offspring that is of a different species. And alongside that, they can produce a visibly different male offspring that is of its own species. So you can have two male brothers that are from different species. And they come from the same mother.
So while that does sound amazing in theory, I think some bit of clarity in terms of what we're calling a new species, because maybe we have misidentified these as being different species, but actually they're different forms of the same species. Not to get into mad taxonomy, because I know people go mental, but how do we define this as a different species as opposed to an unusual subspecies?
So they haven't discovered a new species. What they've in fact discovered is how these species interact. So they knew that the Messer ibericus was somehow interacting with the Messer structor. But the problem they had was that these two species of ants are typically separated by thousands of kilometers. So they just couldn't understand how the mating occurred.
Right.
So they assumed that the queen of one species was mating with a male of the other.
Huh.
What they didn't realize is that there was actually a kind of a latency in the Messer Ibericus for them to be able to produce the other type of species just through sexual reproduction.
So but what I'm saying is
that other species at all.
But what I'm saying is how is it fair to say they're different species if they're coming from the same parent?
Yeah. Now, I acknowledge my limitations when it comes to these things too. But as I understand it, one of the key definitions of identifying two distinct species is that if they have sex together, they can produce an offspring. So the hybrids here would not be able to mate. They would not be able to produce a new offspring. So they are genetically distinct at the point of birth sufficiently for them to be termed distinct species. It's incredible.
Cool, isn't it? Yeah, absolutely.
It's absolutely. I think we see so much amazing evolutionary science when it comes to looking at insects like this because of the way they can cycle, also the huge numbers of them, etc. And of course, there are no doubt evolutionary advantages and disadvantages to doing this. But here's a world first.
Yeah.
Yeah. Foreign birth. Xenoparity.
Xenoparity is your word for the day, Dr. Shane Bergen from UCD, and from DCU, Dr. Susan Kelleher. Thank you very much. You're listening to Futureproof on News Talk. For the past 16 years, we have been waiting for signs of extraterrestrial life. We have what has been called the clearest sign yet of ancient life on Mars, but we're not talking about little green men, and we're still very much on the maybe side of it, but it's still exciting nonetheless. Professor Sanjeev Gupta is from Imperial College London. He's a member of the Perseverance Rover Science Team, and he's a professor of Earth Science there. Welcome to the program, Sanjeev.
Thank you.
Remind us about Perseverance. Which of the rovers was Perseverance, and how long has it been there, and what has been the mission so far, please?
So Perseverance is the most recent NASA rover on Mars. It's been there since 2021, I believe. Gosh, I forget. it seems endless, but it's a beautiful, beautiful rover. And what it's doing is exploring a site on Mars called Jezero Crater, which we believe was a former, can tell now, was a former lake. And what it's doing is it's actually collecting samples. It's exploring the geology of this crater. And actually, we're outside the crater at the moment, trying to find ancient habitable environments. And what we're doing is we're collecting samples for future return to Earth, because most scientists don't believe that we'll find life on Mars with a rover and be able to confirm it, unless we see a dinosaur bone. You know, we're all waiting to see a little ammonite in the rocks or a dinosaur bone, you know, or even a, you know, fossilized footprint. That would be great. But
yeah, that'd be good. That'd be good.
No, so we're looking for evidence for ancient microbial life, and that's really likely to be preserved in the rocks and chemical signatures. But to really prove that, we'd need to analyze those in Earth laboratories. So we're collecting these samples. They're on board the rover. We've collected about 30 samples now. And what we want to do is to really analyze them in Earth laboratories in the way that the lunar samples were analyzed in Earth laboratories.
Yeah. So how do you pick a piece of rock to sample and bring home? Because there's only a certain amount of space you have. And these have to be really, really high potential samples to be bothered bringing them back, right?
Yeah. So it's actually really, really hard. In the early days, when we had a full set of empty tubes, we were collecting randomly. This looks like a good sample. And we have, you know, actually we have spectacular samples. They are really, really good. A lot of unexpected things that we didn't expect, which actually give us a lot of information about Mars's early history.
Right.
Each sample is going to change our understanding of Mars. So it's really great. But now that our cache, the available tubes, is getting full, we're getting quite stressed, I have to say, about
really, yeah,
do we collect this sample or not? And what we do is, you know, we'll get to, obviously, firstly, we've mapped the areas using orbital images. So, you know, images taken by satellites going around Mars. And we have some idea of the chemistry from spectrometers on board those rovers or those orbiters. And then when we're on the ground, obviously it's very limited where you can go with a rover, and we'll select sites that look interesting, that have interesting signatures in terms of the orbital spectra and look like they have interesting geology. And we'll target those both for the chemistry and for the geological features, you know, the interesting features in the rocks. Are they environments? Do they foretell environments that might have been habitable in the past? And then we'll use some really high resolution instruments on the rover. We have two in particular, which were central to this paper that's just been published, called Pixel and Sherlock. They're both geochemistry instruments. And we'll deploy those to look for Sherlock looks for organics. It's something we call a Raman spectrometer. It looks for organics in the rocks, and we'll deploy that to see if there's organics present. And then Pixel is X-ray fluorescence. And what it does is it does produces a little map, about a postage size stamp map of a rock site. And it can map the mineralogy to the grains present or the materials present in the rocks. So you can sort of compare the chemistry to the textural features in the rock.
Right. And so the thing that's exciting is that these leopard spots on a rock sampled by Perseverance look like very, very good candidates for what may have been microbial life. Is that what we're talking about? We're not talking about anything big, but we're talking about very, very tiny, but tiny life that may have lived in this lake and river.
And it's not really the life itself. It's not a fossil in that sense. What we're seeing is the chemical traces of either non-biological processes or biological processes.
What does that mean?
So it means that the leopard spots themselves are recording what we call redox reactions. So there's reduction oxidation reactions, so complex geochemical reactions. And what's happened is that the rocks themselves contain hematite, iron-3 minerals, and they've in the spots they've been reduced to iron-2, and as a result there've been all these interesting chemicals and minerals formed. Now those chemical reactions can take place without biology, but they can also take place due to biological processes.
Oh that's a lot less
exciting. No, it's very exciting because it's the first time it's the first time we've had something that could be produced by biology.
Oh, really? Oh, so it's the first time that anything that could be, up until now, you've been able to write it off as this couldn't be produced by biology.
Yeah, we've not seen anything. We've not seen anything in the past that says, oh, this could be produced by biology. So the first time, and so these spots, we see them ubiquitously on Earth, in rocks on Earth, and typically they're associated with microbial activity.
Okay. So
that's why we're excited.
Okay, so let's just track back a bit and just talk about this site. So you talked about lakes and people have talked about rivers. What exactly, what time frame are we talking about? And was Mars as full of water as Earth was at some point? Or were these lakes and rivers very rare? And was it water that formed these lakes?
So certainly what we know is that 3.5 billion years ago and older, Mars was much more Earth-like. So there's abundant evidence now. And then the previous rover, Curiosity, really showed this. I work on the Curiosity rover as well. And we had, you know, rocks containing pebbles, which could have only moved by water. You know, when you have a pebble that's, you know, 5 centimeters in diameter, there's no wind process that can move that. And they're beautifully rounded. So that's clear evidence for water. And then Curiosity discovered abundant evidence for ancient lakes that existed for hundreds of thousands, if not millions of years. So we know there was abundant water, and we know that Jezero Crater contained a lot of water. Now, the site that this sample has been collected from, these leopard spots have been discovered, was actually a bit unusual because it's actually in an ancient river valley, and you wouldn't expect there to be standing water, a lake in an ancient river valley. But when we drove into the valley, we saw these really white, light-toned rock deposit. And when we examined in detail, this rock deposit was a mudstone, so very, very fine grained rock, and had these beautiful laminations, really thin layers, that could only be the result of sediment falling out of, you know, out of a water body. So we know there was a lake present here. And so that's great because we have a habitable environment.
Yeah, yeah. That's very cool. And so you have, you've got water, you know, you've got water, you've got a lake, which means, you know, a body of water, which is, you know, prime for life. And now you have these suspicious looking spots that you've sampled, presumably.
And then we have one. Yeah. And then we have one other thing. So the Sherlock instrument detected organic matter throughout this. Yeah,
organic matter is very, I think as a term, we need to change it, because organic matter immediately makes you think, oh, we're talking about life. But organic matter is not life necessarily.
It's a carbon bearing compounds.
But isn't a rock a carbon bearing compound?
Not all rocks.
But some rocks.
Some rocks. These are some rocks, but you know, these are.
So what defines something organic then? Because obviously organic is good if we're looking for life.
Yeah. So I think it's carbon-carbon compounds. You know, it's like chemistry. You have inorganic chemistry and organic chemistry. They're two different parts, basically. So, but organic compounds can be biotic, biological, or abiological. So, for example, Curiosity discovered abundant organic compounds at Gale Crater in mudstones that were, you know, 3.5 billion years old, but they're not thought to be life, biotic.
Right.
They're thought to have been delivered by meteorites. But, you know, life can feed on organic compounds. So that's the key thing. And it can use organic compounds for creating energy. So, for example, if microbes existed on Mars in its early history, they could be using this organic material for these chemical reactions that for deriving energy.
I have in my hand this piece of rock that has a leopard spot on it.
Yeah.
I'm going to give it to you. Can you tell me today if that came from life on Mars?
Only if we could do a lot of...
You can do whatever you want with it, but I'm giving it to you. I'm giving it to you in general. You will know. Yeah. So in 10 years time, how many samples have you taken?
We've taken one sample of this because we have.
But all the samples of Perseverance 6.
Oh, we've taken about 30 now, something like that. Yeah.
Okay. So by the time 10 years time, we're going to go back to Mars. We're going to pick stuff up. I don't have to wonder about whether or not there's life on Mars. In 10 years time, we should really be able to say we've looked as best we can, the best chance of understanding it, and it just doesn't seem to have been abundant life. So you will either have yes or no in 10 years time.
Yeah, I think.
I want a guarantee, Sanjeev, otherwise the deal's off. The deal's off.
No more
funding.
This is one of our best chances. You do have to remember, we've only looked in a couple of places on Mars in any detail. Mars is a big place.
But this was picked as a good site. It was the best possible site. We're picking the best possible samples. This to me is,
yeah.
So if we haven't found life there, I'm going to say I've given up on life on Mars. I'm going to look elsewhere.
I'd say we'd in Earth laboratories in 10 years time, we'd have a pretty good shot at being able to.
One last question.
Yeah.
One last question. I want to ask you this. Do you think any of the samples will prove organic life? What do you think? This is news. This is NASA. This is my mate Sanjeev.
My mate Sanjeev. Yeah. I'm hopeful.
No, that's not an answer.
I wouldn't.
That's Ben sitting. Do you think that in that 30 samples we have proof of life?
I can't say that. As a scientist, I just can't say.
I know, but what do you feel, Sanjeev?
What I feel? You're trying to get the emotional me. Yes.
Well, I just, I do think,
because to me, it's extremely surprising. You know, these rocks are the same age as rocks on Earth that we found the earliest evidence for life. And so it seems really surprising that life would only arise on Earth.
I'm with you on that one. I absolutely believe that. But we may not get the smoking gun in 10 years time is what you're telling me.
Yeah, we may not get.
We've got a good
shot. But we will continue searching.
Well, it's been absolutely wonderful speaking with you. Professor Sanjeev Gupta is from Imperial College London, working on the Perseverance rover, and has the clearest sign yet of life on Mars. We'll have to wait a number of years until we find out whether or not it is life. But for now, Sanjeev, thanks for your time.
Thank you very much.
All right, time to look back at some of your comments from last week's program. We spoke to Professor Redmond O'Connell, who has just acquired a very impressive machine that it can scan the brain while someone is walking around. It's a cap that's non-invasive and gives a good resolution of what's going on in terms of cognitive thought by picking up micro changes in magnetism within the brain, because the brain runs on electricity, and so tiny changes in magnetic fields is how this machine actually works. And it kind of gives you a sort of a mix of an EEG and an MRI. It can be really, really useful. And so he came in to talk to us about it. James says, how much do you think this could enhance our understanding of cognitive processes? Well, it's not the only machine of its kind, but it's one of a few. And I suppose it depends on the research being undertaken. Louise asked something similar. Could this lead to earlier or more accurate diagnoses of brain disorders, and how might that change current medical protocols? You know, as Redmond said, this is basic research. And so for what he's doing on it is really trying to understand how thinking happens, how decision-making happens within the brain. But Fee says, what's the potential for this technology to be used in child developmental research, especially for detection of neurodevelopmental conditions? Again, it depends on who's using the machine and for what. One of the things Redmond said is there's a whole bunch of people who have asked from lots of different organizations for time on this machine, because it can really help them with their research. So that could be brain disorders. It could be neurodevelopmental disorders, but it depends on who's doing that research. It's not what Redmond O'Connell is currently using it for. We also spoke to Professor Claudia Monaco, who's looking at heart attacks in Oxford University. And we got two questions. Are there certain infections or triggers that seem more likely to provoke plaque rupture, which is what causes heart attacks when the plaque that's built up around your heart breaks off? And could antibiotic resistance complicate treatment surgeries? So there are things that can provoke plaque rupture, such as infections, and they can spark inflammation and break off the plaque. So that answers the first question. And then, yes, it is possible that rising antibiotic resistance can complicate treatment of heart attack by making the care more difficult to deal with by not being able to deliver antibiotics. But it's not something that we discussed, so I'm not sure how significant that is of an issue. That's it from us on this week's episode. Thanks to Marisa Sullivan, Rory Galvin, and Hugo De Silva on sound. Thank you for listening. We'll be back with more Future Proof in your podcast feed on Tuesday. In the meantime, stay curious.
Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
Sundays from midday on News Talk.